a coupling constant, a tunable coupling constant. And you have maximal supersymmetry in six dimensions. So if you're not familiar with them, the first questions you might ask is, do they really exist? And there's been a lot of evidence gathered over the last decades. I'm not going to attempt to review it, but let me just say that they appear naturally in many string and M-theory constructions. In particular, these theories should describe the low-unit dynamics of coincident and firebrains in M-theory. So if you're really, if you're willing to accept that these theories might exist, then the next questions we might want to ask are, how do we define them, and how do we calculate observables? And the motivation for my talk is to try to understand, try to answer partially the last point. How do we calculate observables? Now, before I go on, I just want to point out that these theories are quite special. And there's good reasons to study them. So from the point of view of quantum field theories, these theories are interesting because they challenge the usual framework of perturbative quantum field theory. Meaning that we don't have a Lagrangian description, and we also have good reasons to believe that they shouldn't happen. So one of the motivations to study the 6D2,0 theory is to try to get better tools to study other non-Lagrangian theories as well. The 16 theories are also special in that the algebra for superconformal field theories have been classified. It's known that six dimensions is the maximum dimension allowed for superconformal field theory. And within 6D superconformal field theories, 2,0 is the maximal amount of supersymmetry allowed for superconformal field theory. And so they really they have a distinguished role, and we should try to understand them better. And finally, well, another thing worth mentioning is that they play an important role in dualities in lower dimensional field theories. So the usual example is if you compactify the 6D2,0 theories on a torus, to get n equal 4 Sapir-Whorf nils, where the coupling constant of the theory is related to the complex structure of the torus. And what this 6D perspective gives you is a geometric understanding of what's known as the Montone and Olive dualities in these n equal 4 theories. Okay, and there's also motivation from the point of view of string and M-theory. So as I've already mentioned, these theories describe the low-energy dynamics of coincident and firebrains. We don't know much about these theories, about these firebrains either. And here I'm going to consider a slightly more general setup where we can also have M2 brains ending on the M5 brain. So I've drawn a little cartoon here where you have a stack of M5 brains, you have some M2 brains that can end on them, and so these are six-dimensional theories. These are six-dimensional objects. Their dynamics is described by six-dimensional field theories. These are three-dimensional objects, so they intersect over some surface within the six-dimensional spacetime. And so from the point of view of the theory living on the M5 brains, these objects are surface operators. So from the point of view of M-theory, these are natural objects to consider. Okay, so there's not many things known about the 6D theories. We don't have a Lagrangian for them, so there's little to say about the field theory description. But what's been done in the past is to try to study them using holography. The usual claim of holography is that at large n, the theories are described by 11D supergravity on an ADS7 process 4 background. And the radius of ADS in Planck units is related to n, as usual. So this works well. It means that we can calculate correlators general observables at large n using supergravity. But the problem is that if we want to calculate subleading orders in n, this requires knowing M-theory correction to 11D supergravity, which we don't know. So calculating 1 over n corrections in general is an open problem. The more modern approach, and this is what I will be telling you about today, is to use bootstrap techniques at large n to calculate. So in this talk in particular,
if IT people can hear me, please mute that. I don't think it's at his computer, it's his speaker.
So in this talk in particular, I'm going to be focusing on one correlator and present the bootstrap approach to calculating subleading corrections of correlator. So what I'll be focusing on is the function of local operators. These O2s are operators within the multiplet of the stress tensor. So I'm calculating this two-point function in the presence of a surface operator. So you can think of this M-theory point and two brains ending on the file. This is a natural choice of correlator to study because it satisfies many properties. So first, it's a simple setup. So it's simple to bootstrap, but it also gives a non-trivial result. Then it's interesting because it also captures some interesting physics. In particular, when we bootstrap this, we can about the theory living on the defect V, and so it gives us some information about interaction between M2 brains and M5 brains. And finally, on a more practical standpoint, the results that we will get overlap with supergravity and also chiral algebra constructions in 6D. And so in principle, at least, there's a way to check some of our results. Okay, so this is a quite technical subject. So what I've done is try to separate my talk into two parts. The first part of the talk will be an overview. So I'll be telling you about, well, first we're doing anomaly coefficients, which are the natural variables in which I can express bootstrap results. Then I will tell you more about the setup of this correlator and how we can deal with kinematics. I'll present the large n expansion and the holographic interpretation of the results and present the results. And then I'll move on to telling you a bit more about how we can get the result using bootstrap techniques. In particular, I'll explain the general philosophy for bootstrapping holographic correlators. This has a set of challenges for this particular correlator that we can solve by deriving a supersymmetric inversion formula. And then as a check of the validity of our result, we can confirm that the result is crossing symmetric. Okay. So there's two numbers which I'm going to spend a bit explaining. I call them C and D, and these are numbers that appear in a variety of observables. C appears in the two-point function and three-point function of T, so you can think that it's related to the normalization of the stress tensor, and it also appears in the structure constant. In general, C depends only on the number of M5 brains. And more generally, these 6D theories are defined for any choice of ADE group. So in general, it would depend on the choice of ADE group. But for this talk, I'm talking about the AN-1 theory, or SUN theories, if you want, at large n. The other piece of information we need is D, which appears in the one-point function, the expectation value of the stress tensor in the presence of the defect. This is an independent piece of CFT data, so it's not related to C. And in addition to depending on N, it also depends on M, which is the number of M2 brains. From a field theory point of view, you can think of this as being some group theoretic object that depends on the choice of representation for the ADE. Other properties of these numbers is that they're related to conformal anomalies of both the 6D theory and of the defect. And so because of that, they're actually known exactly. And I'm quoting here the values for the SUN theory and for the symmetric representation for D. And I'll be using these values at large n, in which case C grows as n cubed and D goes like n times n, which is proportional to the number of n cubed names and n five names. Yes. Yes. So I think as far as my knowledge goes, there's a free constant that appears in these three-point functions, and there's a conjecture that at least in some bases they're all the same. Yes. Yes. That's due to supersymmetry. There's another anomalic coefficient in 6D, which is, so these are like related to invariants built out of the Val tensor. There's also an anomalic coefficient related to the Eulerian density, and that one is different.
Okay.
That one is different. It's another Val. Okay, so let me go through the kinematics for the correlator. I'm using the following notation. So O2 is the superprimary multiple. So it's an operator of dimension 4. It transforms under, so the theory has SO5 R symmetry. That operator transforms into the symmetric traceless representation with two indices like this. And it will be convenient for us to simply contract these indices with some vector U, which I'm introducing. And so this is manifestly symmetric. To impose tracelessness, I'll just require that U squares to zero. And that means that in all my expressions, I can write expressions in terms of U instead of carrying indices everywhere. If you're not familiar with this notation, you can just bear in mind that at any point, you can there's a standard procedure to remove the U's and write this in index form again. Another thing we need to know is that surface operators break some of the symmetries of the vacuum. So they break down the 6D conformal group, SO26, down to a 2D conformal group along the plane, and SO4 rotations of the space transverse. Maybe I haven't mentioned, but I'm considering, so these surface operators in general can be defined for any surface, but here I'm choosing a plane, which is why I have this symmetry. We also have, they also break some of the R symmetry, so if they will reduce the R symmetry from SO5 down to SO4. And because you break the symmetry, it implies that some of the operators can acquire an expectation value. In particular, for O2, you can write a one-point function like this. So you have a kinematic structure here. So the only thing it can depend on is the distance to the defect. The power 4 here is fixed because it has dimension 4. And the reason you have U perpendicular, which is the one vector specified by this R symmetry breaking. And the reason it has power 2 here is because this operator on the left-hand side has two powers of U, right, just from this contraction. And therefore, there needs to be two powers of 2 on the right-hand side, and this is the only thing you can write. The prefactor itself is also quite interesting. So as I've mentioned, D appears in the one-point function of stress tensor in the presence of D. Since O2 is in the same multiplet, it also appears in this one-point function. And I'll be using a normalization where all the operators have two-point functions, which is essentially unit normalized. So because of that, there's a factor of square root of C appearing here. Okay, so now to some more complicated correlator. We can write the two-point function like this. So I'm factoring out here some kinematic factor, which is just the product of the one-point function kinematic. And what I'm left with is some function of cross ratios, which I can define in a way which is very similar to that of four-point functions. So you have functions of cross ratios Z and Z bar. And this sigma here, you can think of it as an R symmetry cross ratio. Or if you want, it's just a way to sum over all the possible R symmetry tensor structures. So if you have something that's, so you're required to have something which is quadratic in U1, quadratic in U2, And there's three tensor structures you can have like this. So sigma just sums over all of them. And what I'll be calculating in this talk is this function here. So it's convenient to just introduce the following notation. I'm calling it curly f. And instead of using sigma, I'll be using omega, but they're simply related. It's just a more convenient basis. So the goal of the talk will be to calculate corrections to this f at large n. I'll mention briefly that these cross ratios admit some geometric interpretation. So you can use conformal symmetry to a kinematic situation like this. So I'm choosing, so you can interpret them as being coordinates for a plane, which is orthogonal to the defect. The defect intersects at the origin, and it contains both other bulk operators. And then you can just use rotation and scale invariance to put one of the operators at this point. Then you're left with one other operator, and the location is these cross ratios. What's particular about this choice of coordinates is that these z and z bar are light cone coordinates in Bash language. So whenever this O approaches z equals to 1, it approaches the light cone of the bulk operator. And when it approaches z bar equals to 0, it approaches the light cone of the defect operator. There's a similar interpretation also for omega, but I don't think we'll need it, so I'll skip it. Okay, so this deals with both conformal and R-symmetry. I just need to tell you something about the constraints from supersymmetry. And you can derive what are known as superconformal Watt identities, and they take the following form. So you have these two equations. And they tell you, well, another way to write this equation is if you take the partial derivative with respect to z of f of z, z bar, z, then this is equal to 0. So it's saying that f of z, z bar z is anti-holomorphic. So these are just essentially their Cauchy-Riemann equation, and that means you can solve them easily. So you can also write this correlator here in terms of one function of z, z bar, and one function of z. And the appearance of this function of z is quite interesting because we know that there is a sector of the 6D theory, which is governed by 2D chiral algebra. This is the construction from Beam, Rastelli, and Van Ries. And you can actually check that for our correlator, if you fix z bar equals to omega, then this correlator preserves the same supercharges that enter the construction of the chiral algebra. So it means that this function sigma, zeta, should be calculated by the 2D chiral algebra. Yes. Okay, and finally, what I need to tell you is that we'll be interested in calculating this f at large n, and it admits the following expansion. So there's a term which is of order unity, just because of how we normalize the correlators. And then there are terms which are subleading in n. First term goes like d squared over c. So in terms of m and n, this is like m squared over n. And this would be m over n squared. And this expansion is justified by you can write the corresponding Witten diagrams. Roughly, they look like this. So the first term here corresponds to this Witten diagram, which, so it's a disconnected diagram. It just describes the propagation of O2, which would be the dual to a graviton on the ADS side. It describes the propagation of gravitons in ADS 7 without interaction with the defect. The second diagram is also a disconnected interaction, but this time the gravitons are absorbed by the M2 brain. And the last term, which is what we'll be calculating, corresponds to a non-trivial interaction between the two. I should mention also that these powers of D and C can be understood from these diagrams. So the general rules are that propagators go like 1 over C, and vertices go like C, and interactions will go like the tension of the two branches, which is roughly D. And that means that this diagram has one more propagator than this one, so it has 1 power of C less, and it has two Ds from these interactions. And in the same way, this one has 1 power of C less and 1 interaction. Okay, so let me tell you what the result is. So in terms of these zetas and F, which, as I said, entered the curly S, so this is the result for this F1 here. The results look like this. So right now, the only thing I'm going to say is that these are, well, they're non-trivial, but they're quite simple, and they're explicit results. So you can go and study them. Okay. So let me tell you a bit about how we get these results from the bootstrap approach. So I'm sure I don't need to explain to you what's the general bootstrap program, but let me just tell you what it is in this context. So the first thing we need to do, well, okay, so normally the bootstrap is the assertion that you have two ways of calculating a correlator using different OPEs, and these should match. So you should have associativity of the OPE. In this case, there is two ways of calculating the two-point function in the presence of a defect, and these are the two channels written here. So the first one might be more familiar. This is the usual bulk OPE of two operators, and then I'm taking the expectation value with respect to the surface. So this is the first way of calculating it, and I'm going to refer to this as the bulk channel, because this is where the two bulk operators collide. The second channel is this one, which I'll refer as the defect channel P. And whenever you have a defect, you have this new OPE, which looks like if I take any operator O in the presence of the defect V, then I can decompose O in terms of excitations living on the defect. And these O hat are what I call the defect operators. Now, in terms of equation, this equality just becomes this equality. So it tells you that your supersymmetric correlator admits a decomposition in terms of defect channel superblock, so this one, and also a decomposition in terms of bulk channel superblock, which is this one. So just a few comments here. It's conventional to already take out the identity contribution from the bulk channel because it's universal. So I've written one already separate here. And the other thing I can say is that this prefactor in front just reflects the fact that defect and bulk channel superblocks have different normalization. The reason is these defect channel superblocks are normalized such that with respect to the leading contribution when the bulk operators approach the defect, which would be the product of one-point functions. And these blocks are normalized with respect to the leading contribution when the bulk operators approach each other, which is the two-point function of bulk operators. So there is a different normalization, and if you take the ratio, you'll just find this coefficient here. And the point to mention is that, in general, solving these equations is very hard. So the reason we're able to do it is because we're at large n, and there's a simplification. And here I'm adapting the argument from this paper. The observation is the following. At large n, the F1 can be reconstructed just from knowing a finite or a small number of blocks. And the reason is the following. So if you consider a correlator in general, you can show that it's fixed in terms of its discontinuity. This is not something that's especially remarkable. It's just a statement of complex analysis. Since we know So we know the analytic structure of our correlators because we know that they're allowed to have branch cuts whenever we cross a light bulb, for instance. So that tells you what the analytic structure is, and then you can use the usual complex analysis arguments to show that, to reconstruct the function from the discontinuity along the branch cuts and the light cuts. The next observation is that the discontinuity can be calculated from the bulk channel loop. And it receives contribution from only a certain number of blocks. These are blocks with anomalous dimensions because they would lead to some branch cuts. And blocks with low enough twists. So the way to see that blocks with low twists contribute is to go back to this expansion here. So when you approach a light cone, these blocks are known to go like 1 minus z to something like the twist over 2. So if you take 1 minus z to some power and you divide by this prefactor 1 minus z to the 4, well, if the twist is low enough, that means that this would lead to a pole at z equals to 1 for the function f. And so if you think of, if you want to reconstruct your correlator, you can do this by taking some integral along the discontinuity. And if you write that integral as a contour integral and you have a pole inside, then you will have some contribution from the residue. So the observation is that you have these two contributions, but at large n, and that's important, at large n, the blocks with anomalous dimensions are suppressed because the anomalous dimension goes like power 1 over c. And so the only thing that contributes to the discontinuity are the blocks with low enough twists. So that's the observation, and that's what we're going to use to calculate the discontinuity and then reconstruct the full correlator. Now, in order to do this, there's three problems I need to solve. The first one is kind of trivial, but like this doesn't take into account asymmetry explicitly, so we need to deal with asymmetry. The second thing is that this procedure is not manifestly supersymmetric. And indeed, if you do that, so if you calculate the discontinuity so for every asymmetry channel and reconstruct the correlator, you'll find that the result is not supersymmetric. And the last point, and this is related, I think, is that this procedure misses some low spin contributions to the correlator. So it misses some of the blocks that make up the correlator. And the reason, like roughly, is that when you do this argument of reconstructing the correlator from the discontinuity, you end up, you make an assumption that there's no contributions at infinity or things like that. You can drop the arcs at infinity. And this is not always warranted, and it actually fails in this case. So it ends up meaning that you miss some contributions to the current. So I'm going to tell you about how we can solve some of these issues by deriving an inversion formula, a supersymmetric inversion formula. So you can start with the usual inversion formula, which is this statement here. What it is, it defines this function B, which encodes in some way the OP data for the theory. And the way it does it is it expresses it as some integral over the discontinuity of a correlator. And here I wrote H instead of F, just not to confuse, because this is a statement for general correlators. Roughly the idea is, suppose you have a correlator H, which is written as a sum over conformal blocks with some OPE coefficient. Well, the way you would want to calculate the OPE coefficient is use some notion of orthogonality for the conformal blocks. So you'll integrate the function against conformal blocks with some kernel, and the result will be the OPE. The OPE coefficients. So that's roughly the idea, but they've massaged it in a way that it depends only on the discontinuity. And it's in such a way that the function you define on the left has a pole whenever there is a conformal block with these quantum numbers in your correlator, and the residue is the OPE coefficient. So this is useful for us, and what we would like to do is to modify this inversion formula in such a way that it calculates the coefficient of the superconformal blocks. So if we manage to do that, that means that I can reconstruct my correlator just by coming back to this expansion. So if I know the OPE coefficients and all the quantum numbers, I can just do this sum again, so resum the correlator to find the full correlator. And the advantage of using this supersymmetric inversion formula is that if I'm missing some blocks, then I can just add them in at this stage. Okay, so let me tell you how we modify this formula to get the coefficients of the super blocks.
Sorry, just a quick question. So at this level, this could be a sophisticated trick for doing a supergravity computation, right? Because you are building in, as I said, the field content in supergravity, and you are using the discontinuity to compute these exchanges, right? You are using this inversion formula to knowing what you are exchanging, compute in a fast way the correlator.
Yes. Yeah, so this has also some interpretation in terms of supergravity. Yeah,
it's basically guaranteed to match, right? Because you are inputting the same fields, same symmetry, same everything. So you know that doing the computation in this way, in particular, your result is compatible with supergravity.
I mean, I certainly hope that it will agree, but I don't see how I know that it will.
I mean, supergravity is the kind of computations that Simon was doing in N equals 4, right? So, you know, Simon Caranoat, from the inversion formula, he was doing similar computations for the four-point function at strong coupling in N equals 4, right?
Yeah.
Using the inversion, knowing that you just exchange the stress tensor, and then using that to get the full four-point function, that, of course, reproduces the supergravity result. So conceptually, it's the same, right? So you know that you have your defect, you are just swapping the stress tensor.
I think so, but I mean, the difference is that, well, I mean, conceptually, the reason it's important to do the bootstrap is that you could maybe go to higher order in that, where you don't know what to do on the supergravity side.
Could you really go to higher orders in that? How would you do it?
It's not simple. I'm not sure you can do it, but like there's good ways in which you can. Let me just come back to this. Okay. I'm going to tell you how to modify this formula to calculate the coefficients of superblocks. So the way to account for our symmetry is. So we know that the defect operators transform under R symmetry. So they transform under the reduced R symmetry preserved by the defect. So they transform in some representation with spin R of S of R. And you can show, you can derive the corresponding conformal blocks. These are given in terms of these Chebyshev polynomials. So this tells you how an operator of spin R would contribute to the correlator. In order to calculate, so what you can do then is decompose the function curly f, your correlator, in the various R symmetry channels, simply by using orthogonality of Chebyshev polynomials. So you simply decompose this function in the various R symmetry channels, and then you can apply the inversion formula to every channel. That's not quite good enough to calculate the coefficients of superblocks. For this, we need to know a bit about what the superblocks look like. So the kind of defect operators that can appear, I label them in this way. So this is like standard notation for superblocks. You have operators that sit in long multiplets and operators that sit in short multiplets, which are these A and Bs. And the only thing you need to know is that the for shortened multiplets, the dimension is fixed in terms of, it's fixed by unitarity, and for long multiplets, the dimension can be whatever it wants. Now the observation is if you go through this list of superconformal blocks, you can check that each block with R symmetry charge R equals to 2 appears in a single superblock. And the coefficient of the overall superblock is proportional to the coefficient of that block, which means that you can calculate the coefficient of the superblocks simply by looking at the coefficient of all the blocks with R equals to 2. So here's an example. I dropped the coefficients because they're not super important, but this is an example for a superblock A, change the notation. So it's one of the superblocks, and you see it's given by a sum over different conformal blocks. There's a single one which has asymmetry charge R equals to 2. And well, it's important to notice that if you try to do this with other asymmetry channels, for instance, if you look at the contributions to G401, well, there could be contributions to this conformal block from many different superblock, which means that the inversion formula would only calculate the average contribution, and then you would have some non-trivial mixing problem. So, I mean, this really gives us a simplification that we can look at only one R symmetry channel. Okay, so if you do all of this, then you can write a manifestly supersymmetric formula, so which defines this function capital B, which encodes the coefficient of superblocks in terms of this continuity of these functions f and zeta. So that solved the second problem, which is it reconstructs the supersymmetric coordinate. The last point I wanted to mention is that there might still be an issue with closed spins, meaning we could be missing some contributions to the correlator. And well, it turns out this is not completely fixed, but as you will see, the only thing that this formula misses are the contributions of two superblocks. And this is to be contrasted with if you didn't, so there was some previous results using only the usual inversion formula, so not a supersymmetric version of it. And in that case, they had to add an infinite number of conformal blocks, which makes the calculation much more complicated. So, I mean, conceptually, the way supersymmetry helps here is that the statement of this formula is that the OPE data, the CFT data, is analytic in spin S, down to some minimal spin. The way supersymmetry helps is simply that in any block you have blocks with higher spin than the super primary, so it just brings down extend analyticity in spin down to lower spin. So conceptually, that's why supersymmetry helps. Okay, so with all this preparation, we're ready to calculate the discontinuity and obtain the parameter. So finally, what we need to do is look at which bulk operators can contribute to the discontinuity of the correlator. And for this, so the OPE between two stress tensors is known. So the notation I'm using here is, again, notation for superblocks. These D2 zeros represent the supermultiplet of the stress tensor of O2. So it says that in the OPE of two O2s, there is the identity, there's again an O2, and then we have a bunch of other super multiplets. So I put them in this table here, and these L0s are the long multiplets. And what you can check is that the only operators, the only multiplets which have low enough twist to contribute to the discontinuity are the identity and the stress tensor. All the others don't contribute at all. Okay, so we already know what's the contribution from the identity. We because exchanging the bulk identity simply means that you have a disconnected correlator, which is the free bulk propagation in media 7 of gravitons. So this is the leading term in our correlator, and we already know it. So we're interested in calculating the discontinuity from the exchange of the stress tensor, which is the last Witten diagram that I wrote. Okay, so you can calculate the superblock for this for the exchange of this operator, and you will find the following. So it contributes to zeta in this way, and it doesn't contribute to f. So if you plug this back into the inversion formula, you can now calculate the OPE coefficients for the superblock, do the resummation, and get the correlator. I've written the results here. The whole correlator takes the following form. So it's an expansion. It's given in sum of superblocks. And using the inversion formula, we've calculated these coefficients b here, and we've calculated the dimension of these long operators. So at this order, we've calculated these first anomalous dimensions here, which take this form. And you can also calculate the OPE coefficients, which look like this. So you would have, you can also have like higher orders in C equations. I've written here like average just to emphasize the fact that in general the inversion formula calculates average contribution from all the operators with the same quantum numbers. So that could explain why this result, for instance, is not factorized like the other one. It's some W polynomial. So it could be that there is some mixing here going on. Okay, and finally, so the blocks that you obtain from the inversion formulas are these three blocks, or the sum of blocks, and the ones that you miss are these two blocks, and they're very special. First one is the defect identity. And the second one is known as the displacement multiplet. And the reason you don't see them from this inversion formula is simply that they don't have any operators of r charge r equals to 2. So you don't see them at all. But nevertheless, their contribution is completely fixed by symmetry. The first one is fixed because exchanging the defect identity means having a disconnected correlator, which is just the one-point function squared. And the second one, the displacement multiplet, is very special because they correspond essentially to the Goldstone bosons that you would get from introducing a plane which breaks some translation symmetry. So their contribution is also known exactly. And so the moral is that using the inversion formula, we're able to completely recover the correlator. As a quick comment, you can check that it's crossing symmetric. So you can also obtain the decomposition in the bulk channel. So again, it takes the same form. So you have this prefactor and then a sum over the various bulk channel superconformal blocks. And these coefficients C times A are products of structure constants with one-point functions. And you can calculate them. And they look like this. Okay, this brings me to my conclusion. So as a summary, what I've presented is using the bootstrap approach to calculating this function f1, so the first non-trivial correction to the two-point function of stress tensors in the presence of a surface operator. In order to do so, one of the challenges of this project is that none of the technology existed, so we have to derive all the blocks and conformal blocks. And what we obtained is the defect CFT data, so these coefficients, the OP coefficients B, product C times A, and the spectrum of operators on the defect. So by the way, I mean this calculates like an infinite number of of a correlator like three-point functions. I should mention that one of the things that we found was that this is a much simpler setup to bootstrap than the Wilson line. The reason is that essentially that conformal blocks in odd dimensions are much harder to deal with than in even dimensions. They're just more complicated functions. And because we have an even dimensional defect and an even dimensional bulk, it turns out the conformal blocks are very simple. And the constraints from supersymmetry are very simple. And that means that we could derive a supersymmetric inversion formula, which helps doing the calculation with less ambiguity. And it also means that we could check crossing symmetry. So I think from the point of view of the bootstrap, this is a good setup to try to go further using bootstrap methods, just because it's simpler than Wilson. Another thing I want to mention is that, so here I've written down the value that we calculated for the function zeta. So it has these three contributions again. And the conjecture is that zeta is exact, that it doesn't receive any more corrections. The reason for that is that from the inversion formula, you expect to get corrections to the correlator coming from the anomalous dimension of bulk operators. And because these bulk operators don't contribute at all to this function zeta, you expect it to be blind to these corrections. So you expect this series to terminate here. In principle, this is something we can check. We just haven't done it yet. So there should be a 2D chiral algebra calculation that gives you. And finally, I want to emphasize that the result we obtain is valid for any representation as long as the size of the representation is small compared to C. So this would be the bound for the next correction. Okay, let me end with a few comments.
Is there any implication of x as zeta doesn't get ordered on our contribution? Is there any implication in the terms of like CFT data, like some kind of like?
That's a good question. So I'm not sure, but I would think that what it means is that it fixes some of the OP data of protected operators. You know, that it fixes the OP data over the important. But this is something to check. I don't.
And this is nothing to do with Susie. This was nothing to do with Susie. Your
it has to do because it's a statement from a chiral algebra, which depends on preserving some supersymmetry. Yeah. Okay. So the next questions are. First, I would like to understand what happens when the size of the representations is of the order of C. From the point of view of supergravity, this is interesting because when the representation is large, we know that, so this means that you have a lot of M2 brains, and we know that it means that you can't, they back react on the geometry, and what you should get is known as bubbling geometries. Now, from what I've presented to you, it's not clear that we can say anything because you know, we're doing a perturbation theory, perturbation in large N, and in that regime, you expect to get corrections which are not necessarily small. But if the chiral algebra conjecture is true, then this theory is terminate, and this should be valid also for large representations. So maybe in some way, you could see some features of bubbling geometries from this expression. I think it would be interesting to see them. Okay, and then some more things, like how can we go to higher orders in N, which goes back to your question. So in the case of four-point functions, so there was a paper like a year ago by Alde, Chester, and forgetting the name of someone. So it's called M-theory at one loop. And so it's a similar setup, it's a four-point function. And there they're able to do perturbation theory up to order something, I want to say like n to the minus 5 or n to the minus 6. They have a few orders in n. And the way they are able to do it is that they use, essentially have an ansatz using Mellin space to what the functions would look like at higher orders in n. And that means that they're able to check the bootstrap crossing symmetry equations. So I think that maybe if you could use some, if you, so there is a Mellin space formalism also for defects. If you can come up with an ansatz, then maybe you can apply the same techniques and go to larger order. The other thing you could do is, in the inversion formula, you already know that, so I've told you that the simplification of RHN is that bulk operators with anomalous dimensions don't contribute. But if you could find already the anomalous dimension of bulk operators, then in principle, I think you could calculate the discontinuity and calculate the correlator at other higher orders in n as well. So I think there's these two approaches. For another thing that was useful, so in four-point functions, this Mellin space amplitudes are useful because they have a flat space limit. So it would be interesting. So I don't think this has been done for Mellin space with defects, but it would be interesting to see if it also works. Here I've only looked at the case of stress tensors in the bulk, but you can ask, okay, what happens for more general operators? This is also important for going to higher orders in n because it helps to solve what's known as the mixing problem for these, which enters the calculation at higher order in n. And well, finally, it might be possible to bootstrap other setups than just a plane. And you can ask me about this later if you want. Thank you for your attention. Well, but I mean, but I'm expanding in the variables of the conformal anomaly. The C and D are the conformal anomalies. So I don't think you can calculate them, right? Because you, essentially, because you can calculate the function, but in order to fix exactly the you know the prefactor of F1, you need to have some data that tells you, you know, what's the order of the correction, and these are the coefficients that fix it. So I think that the bootstrap calculation wouldn't see these. Wouldn't be able to calculate. But they do the calculation in supergravity, right? And there it's fine. There you can calculate. Because there you won't have a C and G. You'll have directly some coefficient that follows from supergravity. Yeah. So you can read from the result what the anomalies are.
And you cannot combine
Yes, you could, but the anomaly coefficients are already known exactly, so there's not. I mean, so the supergravity calculation of this correlator is not known. It hasn't been done, so I wouldn't know like where.
Thank you.